before I begin, just want to give one quick plug, which is we are running a marriage, let's call it a marriage enrichment course or the like here. Starts on the 20th of January. We have three couples signed up, which is enough to do it, but it'd be great to have more. So if you want to do that, Breeze and I are signed up, and if you want to come and join us and the other couples, then come along. If you're interested, let me know, or if you know Stephen and Sharon Harrison, who are organizing the course, let them know, and that'd be great. Let me add my Happy New Year to Nick's. I hope you had a great Christmas and New Year. We had our Christmas up north with Breeze's family, and our New Year down south here in Whitney with my family. So we've had lots of quality time with family and lots of eating. And we wanted to be good guests and receive what was given to us. So when I got back yesterday, I jumped straight on the bathroom scales. One of the first things I did, and I looked down to see what it said, and it said low. Isn't that good? It said low. Breeze thinks it's a battery. I'm not receiving that. I got good news from the bathroom. Less good news from the bedroom. I went to try on some clothes, and mysteriously, they've all shrunk. And this happened last year as well, and it's probably happened to your clothes too. So we don't know what's happening. But anyway, I am not here under any illusions this morning. If you look at the 52 Sundays of the year and say which theoretically is the happiest, it probably wouldn't be this one, would it? Actually, could I have the first slide up, just the title slide? You know, we are, some of you have been working over the holiday period, but for a lot of us, back to work tomorrow, the holiday's coming to an end, school runs are beginning again. As Nick has said, you know, we're thinking maybe you need to do a bit more exercise now and go on a diet and all of that sort of thing. So I'm not assuming when I, you know, walked up here that you're all inside going, yay, a sermon. You may not feel like that. If I was thinking, if preachers could actually read people's minds when they got up, they may just go straight back down. And I was chatting to Tim about this before Christmas. He said, about today, and he said, oh, don't worry. He said, nobody will care. Just keep it short. Nobody will mind. In fact, he said, why don't you light a candle and we can just look at that for 30 minutes. So for you, Tim, for you, there's your candle. Yeah, you start your watch. So, as it happens, we are starting a new series today, and it's called Moses Encounters with God. And so here's the title slide. And as you follow the stories from left to right across, you will see the things we're going to be looking at. First of all, we're beginning today with how Moses encountered God's holiness and God's call at the burning bush. And then how he encountered that side of God's judgment with the 10 plagues. And then the parting of the Red Sea there, God's deliverance. And then you've got water from the rock and manna from heaven, God's provision. And then he encountered the God who answers prayer. That's Moses in the battle with the Amalekites. And then the God of anger when the children of Israel made that golden calf. God wanted to destroy the nation and begin again with Moses. And then we've got Moses encountering the God of glory on Mount Sinai, and his face glowed. And then, although it's out of chronological sequence, just before we reach Easter, we're looking, going back to the God who saves, looking at the Passover. So this is not a sort of systematic look at the Exodus narrative. This is focusing on particular encounters that Moses had with God that helped him to understand who God is. Because Moses was dealing with a God of love, power, and holiness. Love, power, and holiness. And when you look at those stories, you can see how love, power, and holiness come through in different ways and in different combinations and what they mean in different contexts. But this morning, we're looking then at the story of the burning bush. And the first verse that Nick just read begins like this. Now, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. You remember Moses was born at a dangerous time. His parents put him in a basket, pushed him down the Nile. He was found by an Egyptian princess, taken into the palace, and raised as an Egyptian. Now, according to the book of Acts, chapter 7, Moses saw himself as possibly the rescuer of God's people. And so as a young man, probably around 40 years of age, he saw an Egyptian slave handler mistreating an Israelite slave. And if you remember, he went and he killed the Egyptian. He was beginning to act as a rescuer. But then it was discovered and he ran for his life. So Moses, if you like, the self-made rescuer of God's people, runs away. And so when we come to the story of the burning bush, again, according to Acts 7, 40 years has passed. 40 years. Now, I think that any idea that Moses had of being the great rescuer of God's people was long gone by then. Why did God wait 40 years to call Moses? Well, it might frustrate us sometimes, but God's timing is different to ours, isn't it? God is not in our kind of hurry. But also, just think, what had Moses been doing for those 40 years? He'd been a shepherd. He had learnt that craft. He had learnt to look after the flock, to look after the whole flock, to know where to take them for food, to keep them from danger, maybe even to deal with the most obstinate of sheep. And when you reflect on what Moses had done in his secular work, secular career, secular job, you realize what an amazing preparation that had been for what was to come. Who better? Who better to lead God's people, those hundreds of thousands, out of Egypt and through the desert for 40 years than a shepherd? So I think there's a wonderful picture here in Moses of how God had been preparing his man for the job here. I think we can be impatient sometimes. We want to get on and do stuff for God. Well, sometimes he's preparing us. And then we read in verse 2 of this burning bush. I must admit, for years, I thought that the spectacle of the burning bush was the fact it was on fire. Has anyone else thought that? It's not just me. It's not that it's on fire. It's that it's not burning. Thank you, Cecily. It's not burning up. I mean, it's even around the world today, in hot deserts, you can have spontaneous, you know, forest fires, bush fires, and the like. The miracle is that it's not burning up. And so Moses goes to have a closer look. And as he drew near to the bush, we read that the angel of the Lord appeared. Who is the angel of the Lord here? Well, if we look at the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, we see it's a very special individual indeed, because the angel of the Lord called to Moses from the bush and says, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." The angel did not say, "Here I am speaking on behalf of the God of Abraham." He said, "I am the God of Abraham." Who is this then? How is it possible for God to be somehow sort of symbolized in this burning bush and for a sinful man like Moses to approach him? How can God do that? Well, we know how God can do that, because that's what Jesus does. Jesus is a form of God, a being of God, a person of God that can be approached by sinful people, as we see in the Gospels. I believe, in fact, I'm convinced that this angel of the Lord is Jesus. I believe it's the pre-incarnate Christ who encounters Moses here. Who else could it be? Who else could take the name of God and say, "I am"? So here is Jesus. Moses, of course, will stand with Jesus again 1,500 years later at the Transfiguration, reflecting, seeing that glory coming. But this is an encounter, I believe, with Christ way before that. Anyway, Moses is commanded here to take off his sandals because the place where he is standing is holy ground. Moses would have picked up all sorts of dirt, uncleanness, if you like, as he walked around the desert. And here God says, take off that impurity. Get rid of that defilement. And I'm glad that Nick had a time of confession this morning, because we need confession every week, don't we? Well, we need it every day, but it'd be good if we had it every week as a church. We need to get rid of that defilement because we are standing on holy ground. This is not holy ground. This is just a piece of land. But when God is here, it's holy ground. That's why that ground was holy. Here's what Alec Matthias said. You may not know him, but I know his son. His son taught me. He's an Old Testament scholar. He said this: holiness endangers the sinner because the holiness of the Lord is not a passive attribute, but an active force, embracing all that conforms to it and destroying all that offends. Now, you might say, well, hang on, we're Christians, so we can draw near to God because we come in the righteousness of Christ. And that is true. We do. But there is still something to take off as we draw near. Psalm 24 says, who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart. Or for Moses, clean feet, perhaps. But you get the point. So I just want to throw out this challenge, just as we go through the sermon, just, you know, what is that defilement for you? What is that uncleanness for you, that impurity for you? Yes, through Christ you can draw near to God, but we're told there are things to take off. What is it for you that you need to get rid of as you've walked through the world with all its contamination? What do you need to get rid of? So we come to a holy God, but the great thing about a holy God is that although on the one hand it's an awesome thing, on the other it's a wonderful thing, because an aspect of God as holy is that he is loving and compassionate. That is part of who God is. God says in these verses here, I have seen the misery of my people. I have heard them crying out. I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them. God is going to rescue his people. I don't know if 2015 was a difficult year for you. Actually, as I look around, I know it was a difficult year for many people in this room. Can I encourage you, as we go into a new year, that God sees. He sees what we go through. He hears our cries in the day and in the night. He is concerned, and he will come down to rescue. He's with us. Well, those are the verses that we heard read to us, more or less. And you'd probably say, so far, so good. But my passage goes a bit beyond verse 10 of chapter 3. And the rest of it really is Moses being very reluctant to receive this commission from God. Moses has a string of five questions, or we might call them objections, to this call that God has placed on him. First one is this: who am I? Verse 11, he says, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And, you know, he's right, isn't he? Who is he? He's tried this 40 years before, failed miserably. Who is he to do this? And he's right to ask that. He's right to doubt his credentials. But I love the way God deals with him here. God doesn't say, oh, but Moses, there are things in you haven't seen yet. You've got skills and gifts and talents that are amazing. Come and use them. No, what qualifies Moses here is not who he is, it's who God is. And God says, but I'm with you. I am the qualification you need for this call. I'm with you. Moses, though, then raises a second question. Basically, he says to God, well, who are you? He says, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is your name? That's what's God's name. Then what shall I tell them? And here we come to that iconic verse, and if you're with me, that the angel of the Lord is Jesus, then here we have Jesus saying something which he will repeat 1,500 years later, and it particularly comes out in John's Gospel, but Jesus says these words, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. Now at this point, I probably have to admit defeat, because you could have probably a number of sermons dealing just with this name of God, I am. The Hebrew, as I'm sure you know, is Yahweh. It's four letters there, YHWH. It's called the Tetragrammaton, not that that adds anything to it. But I think when you look at this name that God gives, I think it's fair to say it conceals as much as it reveals, really. And people have written a lot about what it could possibly point to. It could say, well, God is saying, I am self-sufficient. I don't need anyone else. I don't need anything else. It could say that God is saying, I'm the creator and sustainer of all. I'm the ground of all being. I'm immutable. I'm unchanging in my character. I'm eternal. It could say all of those things, couldn't it? I like to think that, along with all that, that God, you know, you have to remember, this is a polytheistic age. There are gods for everything in the surrounding nations. God for this, God for that. And that's why they needed to know their names, because if they knew the name, they knew what the God did. But God is saying, I can't just give you a name, as if that summarizes me, and that's the entirety of who I am. If I gave you a name, it would be a tiny facet of a multifaceted thing. And so we have this generic, fundamental choice of name for God of I am. You know, and I think it's just a reminder to us. You know, I don't know if you've been a Christian a long time. Some of you have. And we might think we've got it worked out. We've got it sussed. We've got God worked out. And I think, in a sense, it's fair to say we will never have God fully worked out. There is an aspect of God that is utterly beyond us and mysterious to us. God, in that sense, can always surprise us. But we have something Moses didn't have. Moses had the I am coming from the angel of the Lord in the burning bush, but we have the I am lived out in flesh and blood, walking the streets of Palestine. We see who the I am is in human form. Anyway, God then, having revealed his name, goes on to say to Moses, he's going to rescue his people. And he's going to use Moses to speak to Pharaoh and to speak to the Israelites. Moses' third question. What if they don't believe me? Chapter 4, verse 1, he says, what if they do not believe me or listen to me? And if they say, the Lord did not appear to you. And God here gives Moses three signs that he will be with him. The first one he gives him, he says to Moses, take your staff and throw it on the ground. Now, this is a shepherd's staff. Moses could have been carrying this around for literally decades. It's the tool of his trade. God says, throw it on the ground. And as he does, it turns into a snake, doesn't it? And Moses ran away. Very wise. And then God says, go and pick the tail up, the snake up by the tail. Now, I don't know about you. To me, that's not the way to handle a snake. That leaves the business end of the snake free to do its thing, doesn't it? But Moses trusts God. And he picks up the snake, and it turns back into a staff. And then, and I apologize for this image, God says to Moses, put your hand, Ruby, you're frowning, I'm sorry. Put your hand into your cloak and pull it out. And he pulled it out, and it had gone leprous. And God said, put it back in, he did, and pull it out, and it was restored. Okay, so that was the second sign. And then God gave a third sign. He said, if they don't believe these first two signs, then here's the third one. Take some water from the Nile, drop it on the floor, and it will turn to blood. Now, this is not how I generally imagine God working. You know, this for me, it's not. I'm not accustomed to God doing this sort of thing. They almost seem like tricks, don't they? Like sort of conjuring tricks or whatever. But I think the key here is that use of the word sign. These are not wonders or marvels in themselves. In a way, a magician might do a trick and you all look at it, oh, that was amazing. They're signs that point to the being and the character of God. And actually, when we look at them more closely, we realize they were very relevant to Egyptian religion and life. And I think Moses would have understood that. So why the snake? Well, here's an Egyptian mask, and if you look at the top there, you'll see a snake, possibly two, I can't quite make it out, but they, on their crowns and on masks like this, they had a snake at the front, which was a symbol, a threat, really, to the enemies of Egypt, not to attack. The snake would bite. And also, snakes were associated in Egypt with the sun god, Re. There's the god Re with the sun above his head, and you can see the cobra projecting out with its raised hood. So snakes were worshipped in Egypt. And what better choice, therefore, for Moses than this snake that actually, if you look later, consumed the snakes that the magicians made in Egypt. Leprosy was very prevalent in Egypt. It was reckoned to be incurable. In fact, Egypt, as you can imagine, as a big city in those days, it struggled with healthcare, and it was notoriously unhealthy. And here God is saying, the thing you struggle with, health, I can deal with. I'm the healer. And then we have the Nile. The Nile was the key to Egypt's fertility. The Nile was called the father of life and the mother of all. And you can just see here, this is an image from space, obviously, just how ridiculously fertile the Nile is, that delta, compared to the land around it. The river itself was seen to be a manifestation of the Egyptian god Hapi, who blessed the land. So to threaten the Nile was to threaten Egypt itself. So God gave three signs here to show his sovereignty and his superiority over the Egyptian way of life. I just want to apply this to us. You know, I wonder what signs should accompany our Christian lives. What signs should accompany our sharing of the gospel? At the end of the Mark's gospel, it says, signs will accompany those who believe. They will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes and not be harmed, just as Moses did there, just as actually Paul did on Malta. They will drink deadly poison without it hurting them. And they will lay their hands on the sick, and they will get well. Those are signs. Now, I know this is in the dodgy ending of Mark's gospel, that disputed section, and it's all footnoted in your Bibles for you there. But there are verses elsewhere that also speak of signs following the preaching of the word, signs taking place in that context of evangelism and outreach. And it's just a challenge to us, you know, how cerebral do we want to be this year in our faith? How cerebral? Or do we want to see God work in power? I want to see God work in power. I'd love to see God working in signs amongst us. Why did God give signs? So they would believe. Now, we have the greatest sign of all, actually, which is the resurrection of Christ from the dead. And we have a powerful sign and changed lives. God has changed our lives. And as we live that out, that will speak volumes to people. But it might just be that along with the words we say, that God wants to act in power. And I want us to be open to that, to what God might want to do in power through us this year. Nearly there. Fourth question, Moses says, but I'm not eloquent. Moses says, pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past, nor since you've spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. Now, I don't know what Moses' issue was here. Maybe he had a stammer of some kind. Maybe he didn't like public speaking. Maybe he was scratching around, clutching at straws, something to try and evade what God was trying to call him to. And God is very clear and forceful in his response. He says, basically, who gave human beings their mouths in the first place? Who gave the capacity for speech? Was it not I? So God says, now go. I will help you to speak and teach you what to say. And for me, this just reminds us that, you know, we all have this sense of inadequacy. We may be physical inadequacy, maybe mental or emotional inadequacy. We may say, well, I'm not up to it. I'm not up to what God is asking of me. I'm not good enough. I'm not gifted enough. Others could do this better than me. And it's true that actually God does send his gifts into the church, and we need to recognize what our gifts are and use them appropriately. But it's also true that when God calls you to do something, that he will equip you with the ability to do what he's called you for. He will equip us for what he calls us. There is a huge contrast here to Moses and Paul. Paul, in 2 Corinthians 12, it's 12, isn't it? Talks about his thorn in the flesh. He had an impediment. We don't know what it was. Probably not public speaking, although according to Corinthians, he wasn't the strongest speaker. But he had something. And he prayed for it to be taken away. And God said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. And we find that Paul actually goes on to boast of his weakness, to rejoice in it, because he said, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. Because God is with me. It's not about me anymore. It's not about what I, Paul, can do. It's about what God can do. We are deficient, aren't we? I'm deficient. I'm horribly deficient. I wouldn't want to stand. I wouldn't want to sit where you are and listen to me. But God can do something with us. He can give us his sufficiency as he brings us his presence. So in our inadequacies, let's not use them to say, I'm not going to do anything, to paralyze us, to be self-deprecating. Let's use our inadequacies to drive us to God. And he will be with us and do things through us. Let me finish. The final one. Oh, sorry, I put that on too early. You've seen it now. Moses has raised four questions or objections and come to the final one. I like Isaiah 6. You know, Isaiah sees this vision of God and in all his glory. And he realizes his sinfulness and his uncleanness. But then he's cleansed. And God says, whom shall I send and who will go for us? And Isaiah says, here I am, send me. Moses here says, here I am, send someone else. That's almost literally his words. Chapter 4, verse 13 of Exodus. Pardon your servant, Lord, please send someone else. Isn't that great? I love that. Because Moses is just so human, isn't he? He's just like us. God's response, though, we read that God's anger burned against him. You know, he's seen the miracle of the burning bush. He's presumably heard the audible voice of God. He's seen the miracle with the snake and the staff, and with the leprous hand. God's given him every possible reassurance in the dialogue, in the discussion. No wonder God's angry. But I love what happens next. God says, you're going anyway. You're going to do it. It's brilliant. He does make a concession. He says, okay, you can take Aaron with you. He'll be your spokesman. But that is the end of the discussion. And I like the fact that at times God is tenacious with us. We should be encouraged by that and comforted by that. You know, there are times when if we say no to God, he will move on and he will ask someone else, okay, and we'll miss out. But there are other times when God calls us to do something and he is patient with us, but also forceful and tenacious, and he nudges us, and he prods us, and he calls us, and he keeps calling us. And he has every right to do that. He has every right to be forceful, because we call him Lord. I mean, Moses, this is ironic, isn't it? You know, pardon your servant, Lord, please send someone else. You can't say that to God. So Moses, in the end, is a reluctant conscript, but he does accept his call and commission. And boy, what a great job he did. Yeah? Moses did an amazing job. I know he made a few mistakes, but goodness me, he was used by God. In fact, he stood between God and the people on three occasions and saved the nation from God's wrath. I don't know about you. I don't know if there's something God has been asking you to do and you've been resisting it, you've been fighting it, maybe for months, maybe for years, and God says, no, I want you to do this. This is my call on you, and you need to say yes. Maybe this is a good time to be saying yes to God. So as I finish, I just want to say, what is God calling you to in 2016? What's he calling you to do? Who is he calling you to go and speak to on his behalf? Who is he calling you to rescue? Maybe you've been struggling this past months with difficulties, and God is saying, you know, I have heard, I've seen, I will come down and rescue. Or maybe it should, maybe for many of us, we just need to come to God and rededicate ourselves this morning. And in effect, take off our sandals and say, Lord, you're a holy God. I want to draw nearer to you, but I know in doing that, there's something I need to take off. Let's resolve to take it off. Get rid of that thing that is holding us back from God, from approaching as we would like to. We're going to sing the chorus just to have that moment to respond and sing this as an expression of your heart's desire, but also, if you want, sing it as a confession as well. It's that song, There Must Be More Than This. The chorus says, consuming fire, fan into flame, a passion for your name. Spirit of God, fall in this place. Lord, have your way. Lord, have your way with us.